Welcome to Lit with Charles, a podcast on all things literary where I interview people who've either written books or have interesting things to say about them. If you're like me, then you love reading, but maybe you're not sure what you should be reading, or maybe you feel intimidated by conversations around books. The main aim of this podcast is to make literature exciting and accessible, and hopefully make you discover new books and authors that are off the beaten track. In this podcast, I try to cover all genres and types of books, from serious historical nonfiction to trashy novels, and I talk to all sorts of authors so that it never feels like the same episode twice.
Over the last 5 to 7 years, this feeling that we have all had, for good reason, that the world was getting faker than ever before, but at the same time, we are raising the pursuit of authenticity almost to a lifestyle goal. And there was a disconnect there.
We live in a world where it's increasingly difficult to make the difference between what's authentic and what's fake. Whether we talk about counterfeit fashion or Tinder swindlers making up identities, there's a real lack of authenticity, which is the subject of the book I'll be talking about today, Authenticity, Reclaiming Reality in a Counterfeit Culture, with its author, Alice Sherwood. It's a broad and often humorous look at the concept of realness versus fakeness across many topics, ranging from 17th century forgers to contemporary technology, and how the challenges to authenticity have evolved over time. I actually learned a lot reading this book and from doing this interview, and I hope you will too. Your book was released in May of 2022, and it won the Royal Society of Literature Giles St. Aubyn Prize. Congratulations for that. Where exactly did you get the inspiration for this book? What gave you the idea? You mention in the book a personal story about a fantasist that was living a complete lie in their lives. And that was, you write in the introduction, the spark for this book. Were there other events or stories that led you down the path to research and write this book?
Well, the germ of the idea was definitely this good friend, and in fact, my boss, who turned out to be a complete fantasist. And that pretty much everything he told me about his life was a lie. And if I tell you the lies, I will sound like a complete idiot, because they are basically the five top lies that any fantasist tells.
The lies do sound believable. When you read the book, you can imagine that a lot of people would fall for these lies.
So believable, particularly if you're not paying attention. And also in this case, this was before the internet. So I like to think I could have looked him up.
Yes.
We could have looked him up. And as well as making up his life, he also got engaged to two of my friends that he'd met through me at the same time.
Double trouble, and you were in the middle.
And I was absolutely in the middle, and therefore I was hearing two different things from my two friends, and it was like watching a car crash in slow motion, because actually you can't run two fiancés at once, because there will be some occasions when you absolutely have to spend that evening, like New Year's Eve, with the fiancé, and if you've got two, that's one too many.
Yeah. And so that's, I guess, one of the origin points. But your book, as we'll discuss in a minute, goes into so many variants of what authenticity means. Were there other aspects that then led you down this path of thinking, wait a minute, this connects to that story of the fantasist and so on?
A lot. The fantasist I knew just propelled me in the direction of reading about fantasists and imposters and con men. Mm-hmm. But there were other things, if you like, imagine a mood board or a scrapbook. Mm-hmm. A fascinating snippet I saw in the paper way back when about a case between Yves Saint Laurent and Ralph Lauren. Mm-hmm. And Saint Laurent was accusing Ralph Lauren of having copied his design.
For a specific dress.
For a very specific, what we would call a tuxedo dress, or smoking, if you're French. Yeah. And it was a huge fashion spat. But it also was all about which one is original, which one's authentic, and who owns a design. So it was a sort of cultural war.
Absolutely.
As well as anything else. And so if you like, that newspaper cutting was on my scrapboard, and a quote which I loved and led to the chapter on art and Warhol, which was Andy Warhol being interviewed to the journalist who was sort of a gushing fan of Andy's pictures. And Andy just said, if you like my pictures, why don't you talk to Gerard? That was his assistant. Mm-hmm. He painted most of them. I became very obsessed by, in that case, what is an authentic Warhol?
Right.
And how is an authentic Warhol, is it authentic in the same way that, say, an authentic Rembrandt or Rubens mm-hmm. is authentic? So gradually that, and over the last 5 to 7 years, this feeling that we have all had for good reason that the world was getting less authentic. Mm,
faker.
Faker than ever before. But at the same time, we are raising the pursuit of authenticity almost to a lifestyle goal. And there was a disconnect there that I thought was very interesting. And I just wanted to go back to the origin and the big forces that have driven us to this sort of curiously paradoxical state.
Big forces, which probably begin with biological forces. And you write in your book a whole episode on quite parasitic birds who drop their eggs in other species' nests and free ride on those species' resources. Out of all these different aspects of authenticity, whether it's biology or art or fashion that you've just mentioned, which one was the most fun for you to research and look at? It seems like the fashion one was pretty enticing.
The fashion one was huge fun because it pitted the French belief that origin is about a creator, Yves, the great designer. So it's about a person. And a very American view, which Ralph Lauren represents, which is origin is about a place. A tuxedo comes from somewhere. It comes from a place actually called Tuxedo. Mm-hmm. And so it pitted these two concepts against each other, which happen, if any people listening are interested in intellectual property, to mirror the fact that France tends to use copyright to protect designs and Americans tend to use trademarks, which badge the origin, if you like, originally badged the source of goods. And at a time when, in my view, intellectual property has gone slightly nuts. So a couple of weeks ago, we had Mariah Carey trying to trademark the phrase Queen of Christmas for herself.
Right. Yeah.
And Kylie Jenner trying to trademark the name Kylie. Kylie Minogue put a stop to that.
Right, yeah.
It's a land grab in those cases.
Yeah.
So I thought that was completely fascinating. It really expresses so much of our confusion about what is original and authentic and what counts as a copy and how it's been distorted by economic land grabs. But I have, as you said, a really special place in my heart for the stories about animals because having written 3 chapters about people who are inauthentic and authentic in different ways, so imposters, con artists, and then how a whole country came to believe in a lie, not America folks in this case, though there are parallels, I became incredibly interested in the kind of mimicry that you see in nature that is so perfect, better than any knockoff artist, counterfeiter, copier that you can imagine. But of course, in this case, the butterflies that I write about first, they're not doing it on purpose.
It's a form of natural selection that evolved over thousands of years and millions of iterations.
And it evolved because it's a brilliant strategy to be a faker. And I thought that was really interesting because if they are biologically wired, if most creatures are biologically wired to fake it or to mimic, which is a sort of subset of being a parasite, I mean, you know, they're beautiful fakes. They look wonderful and they look just like the object they're imitating, but they are effectively parasites because they're copycats. Mm-hmm. And parasitism, if that's the right pronunciation, is all over the natural world. I mean, biologists have described it as the most popular lifestyle, not lifestyle
most
choice.
Popular strategy to successfully replicate in the
animal. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is. You know, you get something for nothing. You get an almost free lunch. So why wouldn't you? And so I was really interested that if all of this happens naturally, if the great forces, as you say, of evolution favour being a mimic or a counterfeiter or what we would call a cheat. Obviously, they haven't invented a morality. Then what does it mean for us?
Is that the barrier, you think, that word you've just used, morality, that separates that success in the animal world at being a faker from human activity, which prohibits this fakery? Why is it such a successful strategy in the animal world and so prohibited in humanity?
It's successful in the animal world if you're not in the majority. Let's say you're a butterfly who's very beautiful and wears bold colours because you're poisonous. You're telling predators that you're poisonous. And I'm a completely harmless cabbage white butterfly, but I, over time, have developed the same colouring as you. So the birds that are going to try and eat me think I'm poisonous, but I'm not. So I'm cheating. I'm like a knockoff Louis Vuitton bag or Burberry scarf or whatever. That works as long as most of the brightly coloured butterflies are, in fact, poisonous. So the predators, the birds, will keep avoiding them. If everybody copies them, a bit like the way that Burberry became devalued because there were so many copies, it stops working. So it is a super, super good strategy in the animal world because there are no codes of behaviour, but only if you're in a reasonable minority.
There's an element of a critical mass that needs to be respected. I'm curious with regard to reviews you might have received from friends, family, or journalists. What was the most popular of all these stories, all these great stories that you put together in your book? Was there a firm favorite? I would say mine was the biological one.
Okay.
Is that generally the echo you received? Or
so the very first reaction was people saying, I didn't realize it would be so funny.
Right.
Because, as you said, the title, Authenticity and Reclaiming Reality and all of that, it's a very serious book. But it doesn't take itself seriously. So there are an awful lot of jokes because I get very fed up with books that are dense and don't engage the reader. So it is written as stories, and it's written as stories that make you want to turn the page. And there are footnotes.
You do love footnotes, I must say.
I love footnotes.
You're like David Foster Wallace of nonfiction.
That is the kindest thing to say.
Oh, is it? Okay, good.
Glad
to hear it.
I'm a huge fan of Foster Wallace.
Okay, good. Me too.
And he said that he always uses footnotes where irrelevant. I try to use footnotes where relevant and as an aside and some interesting bit of information, some kind of slightly slanty sideways look at things. But it was important to me because a lot of this stuff is very funny.
Absolutely.
And so I was very pleased about that. And I realized that it was something that, despite the fact the book has got a sort of comedy nose and glasses and brows on the front, that I need to say to people, by the way, it's a good fun read. I was really pleased about that. The reviewers that loved the Warhol story because Warhol is always a great character to talk about. I think for me, the really interesting feedback is what really shocked people is there is one chapter with no jokes at all. And the reason for that is it's about counterfeit pharmaceuticals. It's people who are faking the drugs that would otherwise cure the mainly children who die of malaria. So A, I can't imagine what has to go on in your head that you can do that. B, what they normally do is put a couple of grains of the actual medicine in, and the rest is sort of talcum powder or whatever it is. So they're not curing, they're killing. And thirdly, by doing that, it's a bit like not finishing your course of antibiotics and therefore helping to develop resistance to that. What they're doing is ensuring that this treatment, which is at the moment the only really successful treatment we have for malaria, will stop working because resistance will build up to it in the population. So you're killing the people who are taking your medicine and you are potentially killing a lot of other people.
You're killing hope that there might eventually be a cure.
Eradication. And the really astonishing thing is, and I think this is the really interesting point about authenticity and faking it, is that the country that is allowing, more than allowing, enabling the counterfeiting of these antimalarials is the same country that discovered the one treatment that works at the moment. So you've got that decision in a way that in the end confronts all of us, but obviously not the butterflies who can't decide what they're doing, which is to fake or not to fake, or in their case, kill or cure. And it's the same person.
Yeah.
It's the same country.
It's the same country, China.
China.
Which is responsible not just for fake pharmaceuticals, but for faking a lot of other stuff, fashion, technology, and so on. Interestingly, I mean, I used to work in China.
Of course, yeah.
And just to share with you the level of organization around all of this, I remember driving past a pretty sizable residential complex and pretty big towers and being told that that whole complex, which probably housed tens of thousands of people, was the hub for the whole African mafia in China to buy all the fake Louis Vuitton, all the fake Gucci, all the and all the fake sellers that you see in the streets in Italy and so on, basically were sourcing straight from that hub. Yeah. And it's that level of organization.
But what you're also saying is there is no way on earth the local authorities don't know about it.
I think, but you do mention it in your book, which is that part of the issue is that a lot of these businesses ultimately are state-owned, and ultimately it goes to, I would imagine, individual politicians at very high levels of power in that country, because we know that if China wants to crack down on a religious sect or a group of dissenters, they do it in 6 minutes. Yeah. But somehow they can't crack down on well-known counterfeiters. It beggars belief. So I thought that was pretty interesting in your book. I want to come back to the story of Warhol, which I also thought was one of my favorites in your book, around the confusion in the authentication of Andy Warhol paintings and prints. And he was pretty loose in terms of his method and the people he worked with and how he ascribed authenticity to some of his paintings. Do you think that maybe part of this was almost done on purpose, that he was dancing around the issue of authentication, of what makes art real art, or is it fake art, or is it Andy Warhol art? Was it a commentary on our obsession with authenticity?
It was absolutely intentional, and he loved subverting. He subverted every part of what we used to think makes a work of art authentic. So, as I said, mostly he worked with his assistant, Jared Malanga. What he made were screen prints of photographs taken by someone else. So a screen print is a bit like a stencil. So it's a mechanical reproduction, and a photograph is a mechanical reproduction. And he, before that, he was a commercial artist. I mean, he really drew very well. We always think of art, it has to have the artist's hand and the touch and the brush and the brush strokes and the composition. He used other people's composition and reproduced it mechanically, and often he wasn't even there when it was being made. So this is a fantastic subversion. He also had a rubber stamp made so that his friends could sign, in quotes, sign the pictures for him. He authenticated and put his signature on all sorts of things he didn't make. He actually deauthenticated, if you like, some things he knew perfectly well he had made. So he was having fun.
Right.
With the understanding and the expectations of the art world. And of course, when he died and things became even more valuable, so that there was
stakes went up considerably.
Stakes went up.
As one character in your book found out. And it's quite strange, the story of this individual who bought a Warhol painting instead of a house.
Yep.
And despite this painting apparently passing what we would consider
every test
of authenticity,
yeah,
the authentication board of Andy Warhol rejected it. So then it's not so funny anymore.
It's not so funny when your painting, which you bought for, I think it was $185,000, at one point is worth $2 million. And then it's worth zero because it's had denied stamped on its back.
That's incredible.
And Joe Simon Whelan is still understandably very aggrieved, I have to say, as are other people. There are other people, not just him. But the impossibility, I mean, this board took another picture, similar one, and they described it as a picture that has been signed and dated by Warhol, but is not authentic because for some reason, various reasons, they decided it wasn't. So you got these very surreal judgments because, of course, you can't apply the old standards of authenticity to Warhol because he spent his life subverting them, pulling the rug from under them. And the authentication board was trying to do that and couldn't do it. And it just finally collapsed in a kind of heap of illogicality and closed down because it just couldn't. It made no sense. So they were issuing these just surreal edicts.
Reality. That
but just... it left some really quite upset people.
I'm sure he was tickled pink by this. I'm curious, in terms of all the stories that you picked to illustrate various examples of authenticity, were there any that were left on the cutting room floor you wish you could have included but couldn't include, or were advised that maybe you can't write about this, or is the book fully inclusive?
There are so many different stories every week about some aspect of authenticity. So a few months ago, it was all about the Tinder swindler.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And inventing Anna. And then there was a wonderful moment when Sotheby's were, I think it was Sotheby's, auctioning the famous Diego Maradona shirt that he wore when he did the Hand of God. And that was estimated, I think, at 4 million. And at the last minute, Maradona's family said, actually, that's not the shirt he wore to score the goal. And Sotheby's were putting on the website detailed pictures of a very sweaty Maradona and the shirt and detailed pictures of the one they said was authentic. And I thought, this is incredible when you start applying concepts of authenticity and value, because authenticity is always a proxy for value. Mm-hmm. We never describe something as authentic that has no value. If I say that squiggle drawing that is pinned to my fridge is an authentic picture by my children, you'll just say, what are you talking about? Authentic is always proportional to value.
Why are we so attracted to inauthenticity? I mean, why are there perpetual forces driving this thing? Are we a species of parasites somewhere that we like to ride on each other's coattails? Where does it all come from, do you think?
Well, I think we know that the forms of inauthenticity are a shortcut, which is why we have codes against them. And some of them actually have rules, like it may be a shortcut to winning an athletics medal to take drugs, but that's not allowed. And then there are other shortcuts that people take, like being rule-breaking or convention-breaking, which is certainly the case with politicians. And we admire that because they're breaking the rules, the code, and doing well. And we don't dare. And I think that's why we love movies.
Like the Tinder
American Hustle.
Yeah.
I mean, there are movies every year where the con artist is the hero. We identify with Leo DiCaprio striding through in a pilot's uniform in Catch Me If You Can. We don't sit there and think, gosh, if I'd been a passenger on that plane, I'd be pretty nervous. Yeah. He's always a co-pilot, actually. Mm. So we love stories of con men because they're getting away with stuff.
Is it that we aspire to the lifestyle, say, that the shortcut affords, or is it an admiration of the bravery, the guts to pull off the shortcut and to stand in the face of potential justice? Which of the two do you think it is?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think the lifestyle is fantastic. And the fact that they dare and they manage to pull it off. And I think the former is what we're seeing with the interest in inventing Anna. And Anna Sorkin, Anna Delvey, is actually a really 10th-rate con artist.
Oh, really? Why do you say that?
Because the skill of the real con artist is to involve the victim in their illicit win. So they show their victim an easy but sort of naughty, illegal win. And then the victim joins in, but they can never do anything about it because they've become complicit. Mm-hmm. So that complicity, that crime done with you, not to you, is the real essence of the con. Because the victim is trapped. It has become part of it. Their greed has overtaken. Anna Delvey never did any of that. She just did straightforward crime. She would rack up a bill with a friend at a hotel and not pay the bill. She was always going to get caught. So what she really is a reality star. She's no different to me taking all my friends out to dinner and then running away and not paying the bill.
Right.
I'm bound to get caught. Yeah. So I'll have a few Instagram pictures of us at Le Cabrice or wherever. But it's not a con.
Interesting. So you write that our relationship to authenticity has probably evolved over time. You mentioned Isaac Newton talking about standing on the shoulders of giants. And there are instances in your book where you show that Shakespeare may have been pretty inspired.
Absolutely was a plagiarist, no question.
Absolutely was a plagiarist.
No question.
That's a big allegation against a pretty big writer.
There's no question. Everybody knows where Shakespeare got his stories from, but it wasn't looked down on then. Actually, what it was a way of getting those stories more widely heard and more widely disseminated.
So Shakespeare is an amplifier rather than a creator of, I think the play you mentioned is Antony and Cleopatra.
Yeah, he spread the word, but what he did was take, and I do actually compare the two, it's actually a comparison that's quite well known, which is Cleopatra's Barge, as written by North, and Shakespeare's, which is almost, very similar indeed, but he's made it beautiful poetry. North's version is actually quite plodding. Shakespeare's is wonderful. Now, we would call that plagiarism, and nowadays I'm sure North would sue, and it would be a shame because we would have never had the magical version that was Shakespeare. And I think because there's an economic imperative now to try and grab each bit of intellectual property for yourself because it can be very valuable.
For economic, financial purposes.
Yeah. If North had said to Shakespeare nowadays, you know, he would have got a fantastic payout.
As you say, we seem to have become much more intransigent in our attitudes towards inauthenticity, driven by economic considerations. This whole lawsuit, let's come back to the Sandoval versus Ralph Lauren. Whose side are you on? Can you pronounce a verdict, the Alice Sherwood verdict between the French concept of the auteur versus the American trademark?
I can't. This is where I'm going to say, well, I know you've read it. Guys, read the story because it's quite interesting how they come to the decision, but also the fact that this particular garment was, as we said, a dress, but based on the cut of the dinner jacket or the tuxedo. Mm-hmm. So the big shiny lapels and the double-breasted, you know, dark wool cloth. And actually, in both cases, there is an origin story for the tuxedo that predates both designers. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go back and back and back and trace the ancestors, you know, they have common ancestors, rather like evolution. My real question is, I think designers, their real skill is both creative and able to synthesize the mood of the time and create a garment that works.
That and speaks to the spirit of the times, but may draw upon.
Definitely past. Draws upon the past, but it has to, because there's only a limited number of things you can do with a garment. You know, it has to have places for your arms and your head and your legs. Mm-hmm. It really is very limited. And I think they're both designers are genius at doing that. But it is also a question of, if you like, evolution. The tuxedo dress came out of Yves Saint Laurent's tuxedo or smoking for women. This is women actually wearing trousers. Well, that could have only happened in the second half of the 20th century because women were not allowed to wear trousers.
Shocking.
Before that.
Gasp.
Absolutely gasp. They wouldn't have done it. And similarly, the tuxedo dress and dresses based on basically male clothes, sleeveless dresses based on male clothes, are very much what women who lived an independent working life outside the home wear. And therefore, they couldn't have happened until a whole load of women were working outside the home and looking to dress in a way that was masculine but not masculine. So the genius of the designers is to be able to come up with something to do with that. But timing matters. They couldn't have created those garments in the 1920s, for instance.
Right.
So they are standing on the shoulders of previous creators, and they're also creating something, but the environment is creating it too.
I was thinking of you this weekend, actually, because I was lucky enough to be in Marrakesh, where I visited the museum of Yves Saint Laurent. A lot of his designs are put on display, beautiful dresses, beautiful sketches, and so on. But I realized that a lot of his inspiration came from other places as well. And in fact, there's a full-on Mondrian dress where he's basically copying a Mondrian painting onto a dress. Big success, huge commercial hit for Saint Laurent. Isn't it a bit hypocritical to be copying the painting of one guy but suing another guy for another thing?
I mean, it's really interesting that he could hold those two thoughts in his mind, because the very fact that the French, as you know, call the dinner jacket or the tuxedo le smoking is because it's inherited from the Edwardian habit of taking off your more formal coat after dinner when the gentlemen retire to go and smoke, and putting on a shorter jacket, which was a smoking jacket, which became a smoking.
Yeah, which was seen as more casual at the time. Which
is more casual than tailcoats that you can't sit down in.
But for us, it's now the epitome of dressing up. But
so he obviously would have known that his smoking, the French smoking, was taken from the British smoking jacket. Source. And yet, not only did he go nuts when he saw Saint Laurent's dress, which was extraordinary. Well, you can't find any photographs of the Saint Laurent dress and the Ralph Lauren one. And I have indeed contacted Ralph Lauren's and indeed their legal team to see if they have any record of this. And obviously they didn't answer.
They were given a chance to comment.
Many chances, yes. So he went nuts when he saw the Ralph Lauren copy. But I think he was also suing a lot of Yves Saint Laurent, the company, were also saying had tens or hundreds of other copyright cases going on at around the same time too. And at the same time, Ralph Lauren, whose polo logo is famous on the, you know, the polo shirts, had a 21-year case against the American Polo Association, who also have polo shirts with polo players on it. And Ralph Lauren was going, but I'm polo, Ralph Lauren. That's my look. And the United States Polo Association goes, well, we've been going for 100 years and we have a legitimate interest in having a polo shirt with a polo player on it. And this battle raged for about 21 years.
And no doubt settled out of court.
It settled. And of course, you're talking about where did the ideas come from? Well, polo was, as a game, was invented by Afghans in Afghanistan about 2,000 years ago. So
who do you pay the royalties to?
Yeah, that's a thought.
I guess this interview wouldn't be complete if we didn't address a subject that I think many people are quite concerned about these days, which is deep fakes and digital technologies enabling a complete distortion of news, speech, quite terrifying technologies that we're seeing every day get better and better. But on the other side of that, there is the emergence of the blockchain, which seems a very powerful tool to provide a lot of authenticity in terms of the provenance of certain things. And we're seeing notably a whole new art market grow out of NFTs that are non-fungible tokens anchored in the blockchain. I guess with these twin developments of this deepfake technology and the ability to manipulate news and reality so effectively versus this quite powerful technology that allows us to authenticate anything very powerfully, are you pessimistic or optimistic with regard to the future of authenticity? What do you think of these different developments?
So weirdly, because I was slightly dreading getting to the last section, which was about technology, and I vowed to myself that this was in no way going to be a fake news book. And this book was started during the pandemic. I found myself with having grounds for cautious optimism, not because we've passed peak fake, because I don't think we've passed peak fake, but because we have got so much better at spotting and stopping the fakers in all areas of life. And I think this is a very natural example of the arms race, which we mentioned. That is, if you like, the dominant structure for all things to do with counterfeits, which goes somebody counterfeits, then the other person gets better at detecting a counterfeit. Yeah. Then the counterfeiter goes, "Oh, I can get better and fool you by doing something
like
even better."
The stories of the coins, William Chaloner, 17th century, constantly out authenticating or inauthenticating each other.
Yeah. So each side learns, each side has the advantage for a bit, then the other one catches up and overtakes, and so on. And therefore, what we saw when I started thinking about this book seriously, which was just as misinformation and disinformation were becoming rife. And do remember, I mean, the internet at the beginning was going to be our savior. You know, it was going to be the Library of Alexandria. It was going to be all the knowledge in the world. And of course, now what we're seeing, to mix metaphors madly, is the pendulum swinging the other way. People, individuals, community groups, institutions, governments, and then international organizations have all got better in their different ways at using the same technologies to fight back. And if you talk to, for instance, and I interview him for the book, the wonderful Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat, who uncovered the names of the Russian poisoners and Skripal and who downed the MH17 jet. I mean, really extraordinary. Simply him and his, if you like, gang of super digital Sherlocks using crowdsourcing the information. He believes that the future is not whizzy technology, because I hoped he was going to tell me about new sort of whizzy technology, you know, satellite intelligence and calculations using the angle of the sun and so on. He said it's community. You know, the Russians put out a picture of a plane saying this is proof that Americans are funding ISIS in Syria. And one of his very large community took about 3 minutes and said, "That's actually from a video game." Here it is.
So sort of Wikipedia authenticity.
Model. At every level, people are, as a community and in different ways, using the same tools to fight back. A wonderful organization called Full Fact, who are a long way towards building what I call a Shazam for facts. So literally you point something at some sort of claim and it will automatically go back to proper sources, automatically check it and then ping back a correction.
Wow.
And they have just been given an award by the very prestigious British Academy, which I think is an award that comes under the humanities, which I think is right.
Absolutely.
For that to become part of things. Somebody once who didn't believe in my, what I call my armies of truth, were going, "Oh yes, there are cottage industries." Well, they're not cottage industries anymore. And again, without banging on too much, if you look, there are two countries that are particularly beset by misinformation from much larger neighbours. And these are Taiwan and Finland, so bigger neighbours, who have set themselves the goal of becoming very misinformation resilient and are astonishingly good at it.
How fascinating.
So if you live in
propaganda busting systems.
From kindergarten in Finland, the teddy bear will help you spot misinformation. The teddy bear video will help you spot misinformation.
Incredible. Is that something we should be implementing in other societies, other countries?
If I had a big country on my door saying, "You're not a real country, you belong to us."
you'd start prepping for...
I can see why
training your citizens to authenticate...
To fight back,
...information. Okay, brilliant. I guess now we'll get to our section of quick questions. I'm always interested in finding out what authors are reading, what they're enjoying, what they haven't enjoyed. I guess the first question is, what's the book you've most enjoyed in the last 12 months? Doesn't need to be a book that was written in the last 12 months, but what book in the last 12 months have you most enjoyed?
I'm going to say The Golden Mole. Have you come across this?
I have not.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's wonderful. The Golden Mole is by Catherine Rundell, who has just won the Bailey Gifford Prize for Super Infinite.
Yes. That was a great book.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
she's just wonderful.
And so, let me guess. The Golden Mole, is that her children's book activity?
No. This is a collection and more of wonderful pieces that she's written in the London Review of Books. And they are full of wonder and history and mythology, and they are about individual animals. And she is both writing histories and wonderful stories mm-hmm. and quirky details, but she is also writing, but without too much obviousness, about animals under threat. There's an agenda, but it emerges rather than nags at you. Beautifully written, and it's just wonderful. So I think
fantastic.
I would go for that. No, it's totally,
the
totally
for adults. The Golden Mole by Catherine Rundell. Yeah. And I will tack on for the benefit of our listeners that she's also the author of the book Super Infinite, which was the biography of the poet John Donne, which I thought was really
amazing.
Excellent.
Yeah, and
excellent.
Won the Bailey Gifford.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, what book did you find most disappointing? Maybe most overhyped or...
Can I say, I tell you what I genuinely found very disappointing is... My book is not a business book, though it has lots of sort of economics undertones and brand, about brand fakes and things like that. But I've really enjoyed doing talks for business forums, but they all want me to look at authentic leadership. There's been a whole movement, I don't know if you know.
I'm not familiar, no.
Oh, gosh. Stay as
stay
you
clear.
Are.
Yeah.
Stay as you are.
Stay blissfully ignorant.
Stay blissfully. There's been a real move for something called authentic leadership. And one book founded it, but that spawned a whole load of stuff about authentic leadership and bringing your authentic self to work, and is part bogus self-help. And I mean, there are some things that are good in it, but as a movement, the proportion of guff to good stuff is just way too high.
Mm-hmm. Noise to signal, too high. What's your favorite book of all time that I've never heard of?
Okay, something you said earlier means I've had to rule out one.
Ah, a Foster Wallace book.
I've had to rule out A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do.
Brilliant book.
Brilliant. Everyone read it.
Everyone read A Supposedly Fun Thing I've Never Done Again. Just off the cuff, what's your favorite story in there? I mean, mine's The Cruise Ship. Brilliant essay. Fantastically well written.
We all want to write
something as brilliant as that.
So I can't say that. Mm-hmm. And even just sort of scrolling down your Instagram, I just think, oh my gosh, okay, so he's read quite a lot of the things that I might have mentioned. So let me try this one on you. Have you come across, I hope you haven't, fingers crossed, Shakespeare in Swahili Land?
I have not.
Yippee.
Fantastic. Okay. You scored.
Good. And I'll tell you a bit about it. Mm-hmm. It's by Edward Wilson Lee, who's wonderful and poetic. And it is literally that. East Africa, in very many ways, taking up Shakespeare, sometimes the migrant workers, the theatres, the people, but also, interestingly, the leaders at the time when East Africa was under colonial powers, mainly educated in the British system, the English system, and therefore all knowing Shakespeare, and then using the concepts, for instance, in Julius Caesar, as part of their fight against the colonial powers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautifully written. Obviously, underneath it all, it's about how universal Shakespeare is. But it's just fantastic because you're taking stuff you know and in an environment that you never expected to see it and the uses that people put it to.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that. Shakespeare in Swahili Land. It sounds absolutely
definitely.
Fascinating. Next question. You're the dictator of a small country. What book do you make compulsory reading and why?
This is actually, I think, quite straightforward for me, which is there is a wonderful book called The Authority Gap by Marianne Seacutt. And it's simply taking apart the question of why aren't women taken more seriously? Why are they taken less seriously than men? Mm-hmm. It's done with a very light touch and some quite good cartoons. So as you can see, it's my thing of taking something serious, but doing it in a way that you want to read it and absorb it. Chapter 5 takes a very good look at all the research that shows that having women being equal is so much better for men. They have better relationships.
Absolutely.
Better sex. Everything is better in an equal society. And we have two sons, so they've both got copies, and all my godchildren and my mentees at work all get copies because it's just great.
It's common sense.
And it's full of examples you would never believe and that are truly shocking. I'm not really on social media, so I've never seen the kind of abuse that people get. But anyway, it's all areas of life, shocking, but not nagging. Profoundly true, very readable.
Brilliant.
And I would make it part of the school curriculum.
Fantastic. For a fairer and more prosperous society, I'm
sure.
Yeah,
just everyone would know.
Final question for you today. What would be the title of your autobiography?
Oh, not a clue.
Not a clue. Maybe that's the title. Not a clue.
Not a clue. It's the book I would never write, apart from anything else. Mm. And I genuinely can't think of a title, but the autobiography that I really admired for its self-deprecation was Marianne Faithfull wrote a book called, an autobiography called Faithfull. Mm-hmm. And she was very, very honest, and she detailed her whole life, including the, years
sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Years and years on heroin. Mm. And at the end, she looks back on her life and she says, I should really be able to come up with something profound to leave you with. And she more or less says, but I actually can't because why should I tell you how to live? So here's my recipe for lemon cake. It's very good.
Wow. Brilliant.
I love that. And I look at the outside world and kind of draw insights that I hope amuse and inform and illuminate things for people. I'm not introspective.
Well, amuse and inform is exactly what you've done with your book, Authenticity, which I really recommend to anybody listening to us right now. Alice Sherwood, thank you so much for your time. It was a real pleasure speaking with you and hearing your fun stories on this crazy concept of authenticity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Lit with Charles. If you have any suggestions or comments, you can always DM me on my Instagram account @LitWithCharles. I try to reply to all my DMs. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely subscribe or follow me, and more importantly, tell your friends and family.